Now, for the documentary here on the BBC World Service, Edward Sturton travels to Moscow. As the crisis in Ukraine rumbles on, what does the Russian President Vladimir Putin want?
At the number one fight club in Moscow, Bakar Galibov coaches judo enthusiasts in what it takes to win. He likes to make it clean and quick.
Strategy takes too long. I'll try to find your weaknesses and I'll try to attack. My attack will be to get you down as soon as possible.
When Vladimir Putin annexed Crimea, the West looked as flat-footed as any blue belt neophyte on the mat for the first time. And ever since, commentators in Western capitals have been trying to second-guess him. What does Putin want? Does he indeed have a clear idea himself of the answer to that question? Good diplomats are often compared to chess players, strategists who take the long view. The former KGB man who runs Russia, as all those bare-chested photo ops attest, has a judo black belt.
I look at where your weaknesses are, where your openings are. I'll try to do a little false move to see your reaction. And once you react to that, I'll use my main move to try to get you down.
Ukraine is the most serious East-West confrontation since the Cold War. So is Putin playing chess or judo?
Of course he likes judo, so it's his style. He's more reflected, he's more reactive, he's genius in tactic.
Putin is just the most experienced politician on earth. He is differently more high caliber than any Western leader at this point.
He makes a move, waits for the reaction, makes another move, waits for the reaction. That's actually not unusual in the Russian tradition. That's very much how Stalin behaved. He took what he could and then he waited to see what happened afterwards.
Because it's so difficult to read Vladimir Putin with any degree of certainty, in this programme I'm going to explore the past in the hope of finding clues to illuminate his motives. Putin's past, of course, but also the Russian past that puts the Ukraine crisis in context. And this place, Kolomenskoye, on the outskirts of Moscow, is a good place to start. It was a royal estate, and the church that rises like a rocket over Moscow in front of me was built in 1532 to celebrate the birth of Ivan the Terrible. This huge whitewashed gateway leads to what was once the favourite palace of Tsar Alexei, who ruled for three decades in the 17th century and presided over the original union of Russia and Ukraine. Misha Spetnik has worked as a Moscow guide for nearly 30 years. Tell us about the episode in which Ukraine became part of Russia, which is very closely related with this place.
Well, that was in the middle of the 17th century. The year was 1654, when the Ukrainian Cossacks decided that they wanted to join Russia rather than to be Catholicized and Polonized by the Poles. The decision was made in Ukraine. It was a fairly peaceful act of joining Russia. And here, Tsar Alexei may have received Ukrainian delegations, the delegations of Cossacks, that came here to ask him to adopt them into the bosom of Mother Russia.
If you go back a very long way, the Russians are proud of the fact that their state originated in what is now the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, and the population is hugely intermingled.
Sir Roderick Lyne was based in the British Embassy in Moscow during the death throes of the Soviet Union, and was back as ambassador during Putin's first term as president.
It's very hard to label most people in Ukraine as being Ukrainian or Russian because most of them are a bit of each and they're intermarried. So you haven't got fixed borders, you haven't got a very clearly defined population. But there is a sense of nationhood, which was very apparent in 1990. It was one of the driving forces for the breakup of the Soviet Union, the Ukrainian independence movement, and they had a referendum in which about 90% of the people that the Soviet Union had defined as being within Ukraine voted for independence. And in the presidential election that has just taken place in Ukraine, again, one has seen that a large majority of Ukrainians do have a sense that they are Ukrainian rather than something else.
And is that something that's broadly accepted in Russia, or do most Russians see that as an aberration?
Russians have struggled ever since Ukraine became an independent state with the idea that Ukraine is a foreign country, because to them it isn't. And it's only 20-something years since Ukraine became a separate state from Russia, and the vast majority of the Russian population still haven't got their heads around that.
If you visit Moscow at the moment, you're bound to be struck by the passions the Ukraine crisis has provoked. Part of the picture is straightforward tetchiness about what many Russian commentators see as a willful Western failure to understand the Russian perspective. Sergei Markov is the director of the Institute for Political Studies in Moscow and a prominent columnist and Putin supporter.
Of course, the past is important because people remember that the storyteller never called the Ukrainians. People here, they never really call themselves Ukrainians. They are Russian-speaking. And somebody appeared to be and say, look, forget everything. Now you will be Ukrainians and Russians will be your enemies. They go, look, stop. We are Russians. We live in Russia. Our fathers, mothers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, great-grandfathers, they live in Russia. Why you should be enemy of Russia?
There is a slightly awkward twist to the Russian version of history behind the current crisis. In 1954, here at the Kremlin, the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev formally presented the Crimean Peninsula to the people of Ukraine to mark the 300th anniversary of its union with Russia. Since both countries were part of the Soviet Union at the time, it didn't seem to matter very much then, and the gift was endorsed by the Supreme Soviet, meeting in the Grand Kremlin Palace, just across the Moscow River from where I'm standing.
Yeah, well, it was yet another stupid Khrushchev move. He'd made quite a few.
Vyacheslav Nikanov is an MP and Putin supporter. He's also the grandson of Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov, he of the eponymous cocktail and the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact with the Nazis, which may help to explain his dismissive view of Khrushchev's gesture.
That was sort of a gift, which was considered by many people as a not a relevant act. Actually, my grandfather, who was in Politburo at that time, voted against. But back in 1954, it just didn't matter, because all these divisions between republics in the Soviet Union was not important. So not much attention was paid there.
And that, for the Russian leadership, is pretty much all there is to be said on the subject. Any Western negotiator who suggests that Khrushchev's gift was anything more than a meaningless gesture is likely to be laughed out of the conference chamber. There are two other, more recent moments of history which have a deep bearing on the way the Kremlin sees the current crisis. The first was Ukraine's so-called Orange Revolution 10 years ago, when vast crowds came onto the streets of Kiev to protest against election rigging. They succeeded in overturning the result of a presidential poll, and when the election was rerun, it was won by the pro-Western Viktor Yushchenko. His presidency went badly wrong, but in the West, the Orange Revolution looked like people power at its best. From the Kremlin, things appeared rather different. Anne Applebaum has written extensively on Russia and Eastern Europe. A forceful Putin critic, she's a columnist for The Washington Post and works at the Legatum Institute think tank in London.
The protests in Ukraine at the time of the Orange Revolution in 2005 are hugely important in order to understand Putin's thinking. This is exactly what he is afraid of. He is afraid of a street revolution. He's afraid of a revolution that will topple him, that will expose the web of corruption that runs the country. He's afraid of people running into and occupying his enormous mansions the same way they occupied Yanukovych's enormous mansions. This is, since really for a decade, we've seen that it is exactly this scenario that he most fears and is working hardest to prevent.
Well, the Orange Revolution was widely perceived, and I think rightly, as yet another American revolution organized in order to have a regime change with a quite definite goal of bringing Ukraine into NATO.
Don't be too quick to dismiss this as a paranoid rant. Mr. Nikanov is an extremely influential figure, and this view is respectable mainstream stuff in many Moscow circles.
Yushchenko was a pro-American person, and they had quite a clear vision of the future of Ukraine. The problem, though, with this scheme was that most of Ukrainians were against NATO membership, and Yushchenko turned out to be a weak leader. In the next re-election, Yushchenko got less than 5% of the vote of Ukrainian people, so that was a complete disaster. But for Russia, that was a signal that the West is playing hardball against Russia and Ukraine, and will be.
I've heard it suggested that President Putin took the Orange Revolution quite personally. He saw it as something that threatened him as well as Russia.
Well, it's not about him personally, of course, but it's about Russia and Ukraine in NATO. What is really underestimated in the West about Russia-Ukraine relations is that for Russia, Ukraine and NATO is an existential threat. Every Russian military analyst would tell you that Ukraine and NATO make Russia undefendable militarily. So Russia will do whatever it takes to prevent Ukraine joining NATO.
Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and at the moment there's no prospect of it becoming one. Indeed, before the current crisis blew up, many people in Western capitals felt the military alliance itself had lost its way. But in Moscow, NATO still, it seems, carries the Cold War's threatening aura.
It was morning when the Russian fighters carried out the attack. Their target, the important military bases here, where thousands of Georgian soldiers...
The other episode worth revisiting is Russia's brief war with Georgia in 2008. When Russian troops crossed Georgia's northern border that summer, it was widely reported in the West as an attempt by Moscow to reassert its control over what had once been Soviet territory. Georgia's leader at the time was another pro-Western figure, Mikhail Saakashvili. Moscow, on the other hand, said it ordered them in to protect an enclave of ethnic Russians. Very much the rationale they've used for annexing Crimea, of course. And Mary Jajewski, who writes for The Independent and is a Russia specialist of many years' standing, is inclined to accept that version of events.
I was very critical of the Western consensus as it formed, because it seemed to me that Georgia was a conflict that Russia certainly didn't want, and it certainly didn't want it then. If we think back to what happened then, when Russian troops crossed the border, they said they did that in response to Georgian aggression against Russian ethnic Russians inside Georgia, in enclaves that were predominantly pro-Russian. Almost immediately, the conflict in Georgia was seen as something that was provoked by Russia. I don't think that is true at all. Putin at the time was in Beijing for the opening of the Olympic Games. Medvedev, who had very recently become president, had barely got his feet under the table. This was not a time for Russia to launch any sort of aggressive intentions on its neighbours. If Russia had had post-Soviet aspirations to have Georgia back within the empire, it could have done that then, and it didn't do that.
Contrast that with the view from Anne Applebaum. The two writers are from very different schools of Russia watchers.
The policy of frustrating and irritating the Georgians into a response and attack, and then the policy of setting up these, you know, fake independent republics within the borders of Georgia that were de facto Russian controlled. That's obviously a method that Putin feels was successful. It deceived the West enough not to create a major reaction, and it destabilized Georgia. It achieved all of his goals without requiring him to invade Georgia with tanks and planes and so on.
But it also suggests those goals, and again, in the light of what's happening in Ukraine, are quite limited. In other words, that he did just want to do the things you've just listed, but not to expand beyond that.
I'm not sure that his goals are limited. I think he feels that he has a lot of time to achieve his goals.
The pattern of polarized perspectives has been repeated during the current crisis since the moment it erupted last autumn. Indeed, contrasting perceptions of the crisis have themselves become part of it. When the then Ukrainian leader Viktor Yanukovych suddenly backed away from an association agreement with the European Union, Putin was blamed for bribing and bullying him. But Mary Jajewski argues that the EU negotiators should bear just as much of the blame.
The attitude of Brussels, to my mind, was completely unreasonable, because they were saying, it's now or never, you have to decide between East or West. And it was described at the time as a fateful decision. And I think that presented Yanukovych with an almost impossible conundrum. And it didn't seem to me that those two things should be seen as exclusive. The crucial decision was actually to be made at the end of November. As late as September, Putin, among others, was saying there needs to be a middle way here. And it was the European Union that was saying there is no middle way.
And what was at stake in that decision for Putin? Was it a deeper emotional thing and not simply a question of economic relationships?
There is a deeper emotional thing going on, but Russia and Ukraine have extremely close relations. I mean, you have to think more Britain-Scotland or Britain-Ireland than, say, Britain and the US.
That does at least help explain some of the more strident rhetoric coming out of Moscow. Sergei Markov has used his newspaper column to compare events in Ukraine to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when Nikita Khrushchev set up Soviet missile bases just off the coast of the United States.
In Ukraine, Russia is fighting not for geopolitical interests. Russia fighting for surviving of Russia. That's why Russia will respond. And I think it's what Barack Obama didn't understand. Obama see John Kennedy as his example, as we know. But his behavior in such crisis is behavior of Nikita Khrushchev during the Caribbean crisis. Because Nikita Khrushchev put Soviet missiles on the Cuban territory, and as a result, Khrushchev created existential security threat to the United States. And as a result, John Kennedy responded quite toughly. Same behavior of Barack Obama as Nikita Khrushchev. As Nikita Khrushchev crossed the red line, exactly now Obama crossed the red line and create existential threat to Russia. That's why Vladimir Putin had to behave as John Kennedy.
So this is the Cuban Missile Crisis in reverse from your perspective?
Absolutely.
Vladimir Putin works from the Senate building in the Kremlin, and I can just see the presidential flag fluttering in the summer breeze above the Kremlin gardens, which lead down to the Moscow River here. It's the office used by Soviet-era leaders from Lenin and Stalin right through to Gorbachev, and it would be unsurprising if his foreign policy priorities didn't, at least to some degree, reflect theirs. But what about the particular character and skills that he brings to the task, and what are the events that have shaped the way he's responded to this crisis?
For an autocratic leader in Russia, it is extremely important for people not to be able to quite read what he's after.
Anna Aratunyan, a Russian-born but American-educated journalist, is the author of the book Putin's Mystique.
Putin doesn't really act within this grand strategic plan. He reacts to situations very pragmatically. He weighs in the short term what a particular response to a situation is going to get him. And that's precisely what we saw here. I mean, he may have within himself some grand vision of future empire, but that's a relatively weak motivator for him. I think it's the significance of that should not be overestimated.
Almost everyone we spoke to agreed that Vladimir Putin is more of a tactician than a strategist, more judo fighter than chess player, to pick up the conceit we used earlier. He certainly has a clear idea of where Russia's interests lie and when they're threatened, but that doesn't mean he carries around a mental map of a greater Russia or wants to restore the old Soviet empire. And although the annexation of Crimea looked like a remarkably slick operation, even his opponents in Moscow think it was opportunistic and reactive. Gleb Pavlovsky knows him very well indeed. He was a member of Boris Yeltsin's inner circle, and although he's now a trenchant critic, he helped push Putin into power. He believes the Crimea move was
an improvisation, and that's what Putin and his team are known for at the moment, improvised rather than strategic actions. This is what I call jazz government.
Do you think that the annexation of Crimea was a mistake in that case, or do you think it was inspired improvisation?
It's an inspired mistake, and you can see that the situation is developing under the exactly the same laws as a jazz improvisation. The situation is slowly but steadily developing to a point where it's becoming more and more difficult to control, but there is no way out of it, it seems.
Mr. Pavlovsky claims authorship of the idea that there's what he calls a Putin majority in Russia. It's a reference to the mass of ordinary Russians who are socially conservative, nationalist, and resentful of the way their country was treated by the West after the collapse of communism. Whether or not the annexation of Crimea was planned, the Putin majority loved it.
According to one poll this month, the president's popularity is at a six-year high, his approval rating well over 80%. But the popularity of his Crimea move may turn out to be a mixed blessing. Valery Korovin of the Eurasia movement represents what you might call hardcore nationalist feeling. His strong sense of connection with Russia's past even comes through his dress. He sports the sombre black and long beard of Old Believers, a traditionalist group that split from the Orthodox Church in the 18th century.
The patriotic masses are not thinking in the corporate mindset, but in the nationalistic mindset or in the imperial mindset. They think Putin should not stop in Crimea and that he should continue with his acquisitions and that he should acquire the southeastern regions of the former Ukraine. So Putin at the moment is caught between a rock and a hard place because his inner circle, his closest advisors, are in panic because they think that taking Crimea was too much. Whereas the masses in the country expect him to continue the territorial gains, so at the moment he's torn between his inner circle and the expectations of the populace.
Valery Korovin may or may not be right. His view could have very serious implications if the answer to the question, what does Putin want, is simply, Putin wants to stay in power. Sir Roderick Lyne, the former British ambassador in Moscow.
Putin's ultimate strategic objective, insofar as he has one, is that he and his accomplices should retain power in Russia, and he's been very successful at doing so over the past 14 years. He doesn't have an exit strategy. There is no mechanism in Russia, as there is in China, for changing the leadership every 10 years. There is absolutely no mechanism at all. And Putin's economy is doing extremely badly. This is his Achilles heel. It barely grew last year. It's probably going to go into recession this year. There is a lot of discontent across Russia with the state of public services, the poor state of the infrastructure, the high levels of corruption. And his ratings last December had gone to their lowest point ever. Now they're back at their highest point. He's diverted the attention right away. The people who were complaining on the streets about the mismanagement of Russia in the last 2 months have been out on the streets waving the Russian flag with delight because they've got Crimea back.
He's found himself pressed to adopt this imperialist ideology, and it could backfire. He's channeling a force that predates him. He has to do that as de facto monarch. I mean, that's what he's come to be. But that is something that's very dangerous because it unleashes forces that are beyond his control.
Anna Arantunyan, author of Putin's Mystique. The prediction from the think tank director and columnist Sergei Markov is chilling.
It's very big public pressure. A lot of people now crying, Putin, if you don't send troops to save Russian lives in Ukraine, you not will be our president. So Putin has to act.
What's your best guess? I mean, do you think he will eventually order the Russian troops into Ukraine?
I think the most probable scenario that Russian government will allow volunteers to go to the east and south of Ukraine to fight against ultra-nationalistic junta. Volunteers will be not only from Russia, a lot of volunteers from other countries, for example, from Iran, from Lebanon, from other countries want to fight against Americans because everybody believes that it's American aggression in Ukraine. We think that now we must support anti-fascist revolt in Ukraine exactly as we support anti-fascist resistance in Spain in 1930s.
Whether the Ukraine's government can really be compared to Franco and his fascist allies is very much open to question. And the Spanish analogy isn't particularly helpful to Moscow's cause. Soviet help to the Republican government during the Spanish Civil War failed. History can only take you so far in an analysis of this crisis, but at the beginning of this programme I referred to Kiev's 17th century decision to favour Russia over Poland and the West. The pro-Putin MP Vyacheslav Nikonov puts the current crisis in terms of an even more ancient struggle over Ukraine and conjures up an alarming cocktail of old rivalries and modern weapons.
It's not about the end of the crisis. I don't see actually the end of this crisis, not yet. We are just at the beginning of some new stage in this long-time confrontation over Ukraine and where it belongs. You know, first time when the Polish troops came to occupy Kiev with the blessing of Vatican was back in 1018. Since then, that has been a never-ending story. And I think that we are now present at the end of history. The forces of history has been unleashed by the violent overtake of power in Kyiv by nowadays authorities. And the forces of history are very hard to predict. I don't know what is the end game there.
You said you thought it was dangerous. What did you mean by that?
Well, of course it is dangerous. There are all possibilities of some accident bringing us to a disaster. You know, when you have American Navy in the Black Sea closer to the Russian shores, and we know that these ships have cruise missiles with nuclear weapons, we're getting where I would not like us to be, actually. So it's dangerous.
Many commentators have argued that Putin's actions in Ukraine show how confident he's become in the face of American weakness and a lack of American leadership under Barack Obama. The underlying message from those we spoke to in Moscow was exactly the opposite, that Russia feels vulnerable and that the Kremlin still fears American aggression. Of course, that could just have been the message they wanted us to take away. As the coach at the number one fight club told me, it's all about reading your opponent right.
Strength is important, but what's more important is that you read your opponent's mind. When you read his mind, you try to get ahead of his thoughts.
No other chance. I must win.